From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to the March 2026 episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast. Dilly and his girls. The 28th of March 2026 will be the 85th anniversary of the Naval Battle of Cape Matapan, fought by the Royal Navy against the Italian fleet in the Mediterranean. The battle was a significant victory for the Allies and cast a shadow over the Italian Navy, making them reluctant to challenge British superiority at sea in the Mediterranean for the remainder of the war. In part, the battle came about due to knowledge of Italian operations derived from code-breaking at Bletchley Park, and it's one of the few successes by BP in that theatre of war which is widely recognised. In this episode, Head of Audiences and Programmes, Vicky Pipe, is joined by research historian Dr. David Kenyon to go beyond the popular mythology of this event to look in more detail of what exactly GC&CS knew and when. Our thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our historical documents.
Shall we begin with what is Matapan? What is the myth that surrounds Matapan?
Well, I started this off with the myth around Matapan because it's a feature of the popular history of Bletchley Park that the focus tends to be all about the Germans. But the Italians and the Japanese were also significant players in the Axis. And it's interesting that their stories tend to get completely overshadowed by the Germans. The Italian story is equally interesting, particularly on the naval side, and that's what we're going to talk about today. But the only Italian story that really makes it into the mainstream narrative is about the Italian use of Enigma and the consequences for the Battle of Matapan, which was a naval battle in the Mediterranean, which we'll talk about. It's almost as if the Italian story only counts when it includes Enigma, you know?
I was going to ask, why is it that you think it gets overshadowed?
Part of the issue is that British code breaking against the Italians wasn't completely successful. They were successful against Italian machine systems, Enigma and Hagelin, but against the book codes, which the Italians used for the majority of their communications, GC&CS, Bletchley Park never managed to break those. So it's not as big a success story as perhaps the German story is, or equally the Japanese story. The Italian story is also interesting because Italy is a strategic interest of the UK almost from the end of World War I, in a way that Japan and Germany just aren't. So it's a much longer story in many ways. But to go back to Matapan, when you read about it in the mainstream narratives, Italy crops up and people say, oh, well, Bletchley Park broke some Italian codes. They broke Italian Enigma. Mavis Beattie, Mavis Lever, as was, in particular, she broke Italian Enigma and she intercepted a message. And that message led to Admiral Cunningham winning the Battle of Matapan and everyone goes home for tier medals and that's kind of it.
So it was down to just that one decrypt.
It's like one person, one decrypt, one battle.
Right.
End of story.
Okay. And that's the myth we're going to bust today.
Well, it's all true, but it's the tip of a much larger iceberg. And I think it's a much more interesting and in some ways more nuanced story than that. Inevitably, when you get these things get distilled down to a sentence, a lot of the detail is lost. But there's no doubt that it was a hugely important event in the history of the war in the Mediterranean against the Italians. But it's a longer story because Italian Enigma wasn't broken for the first time in 1941. Italian Enigma had actually been being broken since 1936, long before German Enigma was broken.
Okay.
So there's actually a lot more backstory, if you like, than is really given credit in a lot of the narratives. The other point that a lot of people miss is that the Italians are also doing code breaking. And so to fully understand the situation, you need to look at what British signals the Italians are reading, as well as what Italian signals the British are reading. This is something I keep saying on this podcast. It's not a one-sided affair, because it never is. Everyone's doing code breaking. To varying degrees of success. If you go back to our January podcast, Diplomats and Diamonds, you'll hear more about Italian codebreaking, diplomatic codebreaking. But this is naval Italian codebreaking we're talking about now.
I think it would be important for us to understand then what was the strategic situation at that time in the Mediterranean. Set the scene for us.
Well, the Italians joined the war in June 1940, and Matapan is in March 1941. So we're about 9 months into the Italian war. Up to that point, not much has happened at sea. The Italians have a very modern navy. They have potentially a more powerful navy than the force that the Royal Navy has in the Mediterranean. It's very modern, fast, big guns. And you can compare it with the Royal Navy at the time. The three battleships that Admiral Cunningham has in Alexandria, the Mediterranean fleet, I think all of those battleships were at Jutland in 1916. They're World War I battleships. They've been upgraded.
Right, okay.
But they're pretty old. The Italian Navy has half a dozen really up-to-date battleships. So if it came to a knockdown fight, the Italians would probably do pretty well. And there are a couple of incidents in 1940, early 1941, where the two navies sort of not quite meet each other and not quite have battles, and it's all a bit inconsequential. But a crucial moment happens in November 1940, when the Royal Navy are able to send Swordfish torpedo bombers from aircraft carriers into the Italian Navy's principal harbour at Taranto in Italy. And they sink or severely damage several of the Italians' battleships, as well as other vessels.
So that's going to make a big difference.
It makes a big difference. It really puts the Italians on the back foot in a way that they weren't before. I mean, they were already a bit cautious about the Royal Navy, but after Taranto, they're much more nervous about their navy. And they distribute their ships. They move them out of Taranto and put them in Naples and Brindisi and in Sicily. And so they're all sort of spread out around the place. Simultaneously on land, the Italians haven't done very well either. In North Africa, in September of 1940, from Italian Libya, they invade Egypt, where the British are. A large Italian army basically marches into Egypt, but it gets about halfway to Alexandria, gets to Sidi Barani, and then they stop and they build a fortified camp and they kind of go, well, what do we do now? And they are defeated in an operation that the British launched in December called Operation Compass, where they basically, I would say they boot the Italians back into Libya. They boot some of them back into Libya, but a huge number of them they just capture. So they take large numbers of Italian prisoners. And the British army continues on its march through Libya. If you imagine the map of North Africa, you've got the sort of the bump, which is where Benghazi is, and then you've got the Gulf of Sirte, where Tripoli is. They get all the way around the bump to south of Benghazi, and that's where they stop. And so the Italians on land there have been pushed right back. But that forces the Germans to get involved because, you know, this ally isn't proving particularly useful to them at this point. And famously, in the spring of 1941, Rommel and the Africa Corps, or what becomes the Africa Corps, are sent to North Africa to bolster the Italians. In 1939, the Italians have invaded Albania, kick out the wonderfully named King Zog. King Zog of Albania is deposed, and the Italians take over Albania.
Okay.
In 1939. In October 1940, they think, right, next stop, Greece. And so from Albania, they invade Greece. They get a grim surprise from the Greeks, who fight very hard and basically kick them back into Albania. It's one of the most successful early campaigns against the Axis powers. If you think about the Germans, the Italians, whatever. The Greek campaign against the Italians is extremely successful. The Greeks aren't going to last forever. And so the British start looking to support the forces in Greece. And one of the things that historians will argue about forever is whether the troops that were taken from North Africa to go to Greece, because the British sent lots of troops to Greece, if they'd stayed in North Africa, they might have sort of finished the war in the desert a lot more quickly. But having made all this progress to be on Benghazi, they then kind of strip out a lot of the troops, send them to Greece. So there are convoys of supplies going to the Greeks. And then latterly, there are troops, mostly Australian and New Zealand soldiers, being sent to Greece to bolster the Greek position. And it's also reasonably well understood by everybody concerned that the Germans have their eyes on Yugoslavia and Greece. And in due course, they will begin an invasion, which ultimately leads to them capturing Greece and Crete. But that's further down the road.
Are the Allies seeing Greece as a potentially a sort of turning point if that was to happen at this stage?
It is an important point. It's not just about Greece, because if you go further over into sort of the Balkans and Romania, that's where the Germans get all their oil from. And there's also a question about whether Turkey will join the war and on whose side. They don't join on either side in the end. They stay neutral throughout. But that part of the world is pretty important for everybody concerned. But you end up with a situation where the British are sending ships from Egypt to Greece and vice versa. And the Italian Navy is in its ports in Italy, licking its wounds. And Admiral Raeder, who's the head of the German Navy, of the Kriegsmarine, basically sends his people to meet the Italian Navy and say, you need to be doing more. You've got all these spanking new ships. You should be out there fighting the war. You should be using them for something.
Yeah, okay.
And so they have a conference in February of 1941, and they come up with a plan, which is to sail from Italy across southern Greece towards Crete and attack some of the convoys that are sailing, carrying all the supplies to Greece. And this is Operation Gaudo, it's called. It's a particularly poor code name. We've talked in this podcast before about you should never give a code name that gives a clue to what your operation is. Gaudo is an island off Crete.
Oh, okay.
Which is exactly where the operation is going to happen.
Ah.
So it's a pretty rubbish code name.
Okay. Do you think they were trying a double bluff? Or?
I don't know. Well, I'm not aware that the British ever found out that it was called Operation Gaudo, so it doesn't make a big difference. But, you know, in the big book of how to come up with code names, one of the things it says is don't name it after the place where the operation's happening. But they did. So the Italians come up with this plan, and the Germans also say, well, you're going to need air cover for your ships. So they say, well, in addition to the Italian Air Force, we'll send Luftwaffe aircraft to support you as well. So you'll have German aircraft looking after the Italian ships. And this is their plan.
And may the fleet air arm carry on with the good work too. We know the results of the recent raid on Taranto, a smashing success, but Mussolini denies this, of course. Though he admits some damage to ships in harbour in the heel of Italy, he has so many difficult explanations to make just now that he probably hasn't time to explain away the proof of our claim. After the raid on Taranto, RAF reconnaissance planes went over to photograph the damage. Here's the result. Top left-hand corner of the screen, two cruisers of the Trento class damaged and surrounded by oil fuel. Next, a Cavour class 23,000-ton battleship beached on the eastern shore of the outer harbour. Most of her starboard side is submerged. Her stern is underwater. And this, another battleship of the same class, down by the head, beach, and surrounded by anti-torpedo nets. That's locking the stable door after the horse has bolted, if you like. And one of the new 35,000-ton Littorio-class battleships, the pride of the Duce, badly down by the head in the middle of the outer harbour. Tugs and salvage ships alongside, fuel oil on the water. All that ought to upset the Duce's plans, if any.
The Italians then have this operation, this plan. How much of it are the Allies and the British aware of it?
Well, famously, the clue that they get about it is from Italian Enigma. But you need to sort of backtrack a bit to understand what codes and ciphers the Italians are using and just how much of it the British actually understand. It's something of an irony that during the 1930s, GCNCS had a very good command of Italian naval codes. They were using additive book systems, and the British had been able to figure out those books pretty thoroughly. And they were reading huge amounts of Italian traffic. During the Abyssinian crisis in 1935, they were reading traffic. And then subsequently in Spain during the Spanish Civil War and things like that. The problem is the Italians have been extremely sensible in their code planning, because when the war breaks out in June the 10th, 1940, the Italian Navy has new code books that they've kept in the safe only to use when there's a war. So in the early first few days and weeks of the war, they change all of their code books.
Gosh, that must have been incredibly frustrating.
It was incredibly frustrating. One of the things that I always kind of admire about Italian naval section is their work of 10 years is wiped out almost at a stroke. And they just kind of go, oh, well, we'll start again. Unfortunately, even though they spend the next 3 or 4 years banging their heads against it, they never really make any significant progress back into these codes. There's an official history, internal history written by GCHQ that was secret until relatively recently. And basically, it's full of, we tried this and it didn't work, and then we tried this and it didn't work, and then we tried this. It's a very long account of them not really achieving anything at all. The problem is that you build these things incrementally over time, because basically the codes work with a dictionary, and you look up the word you want to use in your message, and there's a number, a random 5-digit number. And so you compile your message by taking each word and finding the number that relates to that word, and you string them all together. Then you have a second book where you have strings of random 5-digit groups of numbers. And for each number that represents a word, you get one of these random numbers and you add them together.
Oh, boy.
Which gives you a third number. And basically, you have to break it word by word by working out either what all the numbers added on are or what all the underlying words are, or vice versa. And that can be done, but it's a very long-winded process. It often relies on your opponent making mistakes. For example, the Japanese use a similar system. If you change the code book, but you don't change the additive number book, your opponent can use what they know about one to work out the other.
Yeah.
But if you change them both at the same time, it's much more different.
You're literally starting from zero.
So Italian naval books are really pretty good. They're aware throughout the war that if you use the same book for too long or you send too many messages with the same book, it becomes vulnerable. So they change them regularly, and they basically do all the right things with their book codes. The problem is they are encouraged by the Germans to use machine ciphers, because obviously machines are better, they're modern, they're clever, they're unbreakable. So in 1936, when the Italians become involved in the Spanish Civil War, because their navy is supporting the Spanish, they've got a huge army and air force presence in Spain, as have the Germans. And so the Germans, the Italians, and the Spanish use the same version of Enigma so they can all talk to one another. And at that point in 1936, Dilly Knox starts looking at that traffic and is able to build on a technique that Hugh Foss had pioneered in 1927 that allows you to break that model of Enigma. So from 1936, they are breaking Italian naval Enigma. The crucial difference between Italian and Spanish Enigma and the one the German military use is it doesn't have the plug board on the front, the Steckerbrett. And that plug board makes the encryption produced by an Enigma machine exponentially more complicated. And so all the work that Turing and Gordon Welshman and people do in the bomb is all about solving that Steckered Enigma problem. These machines that don't have the plug board, Foss's technique, he invented a technique called rectangling, which is basically you draw rectangles of letters on squared paper and you can work it out. That technique is taken by Dilly Knox during the Spanish Civil War and turned into a technique that becomes known as rodding, because you have cardboard strips with alphabets written on them that reflect the different rotors in the machine. And by manipulating the rods, you can work out what the messages say. It's an extraordinarily tedious process. And it's one of these things where you have to kind of guess. And if you don't get it, you guess again. And you just do iterations and iterations of these, moving these rods around attritionally until you get what you want. The principle of it, which Foss described when he first came up with it, is the idea that because the rotors in the Enigma work like an odometer in a car, the first one, when it's gone around 26 positions, it moves the next one one click. And then that one moves the next one click. If you take a message, you can guess that somewhere between 1 and 26 of the letters in the message, only one rotor will be moving. And if you sort of pretend that the other two rotors and the reflector and back through the other two rotors is just what he describes as a lump, which always produces the same encryption, you think about the moving wheel and everything else, you can actually work it out.
Okay, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah, it's complicated, but it is doable. But that stops in 1939 because the Italians stop using the machine. In 1940, after they've entered the war, the Italian Navy starts using Enigma machines again.
What do you think prompted that?
Well, there is a suggestion that they were being lent on a bit by the Germans, and they don't use it for their ships at sea. Their ships at sea are still using these books, which are perfectly secure. But there's a network of the naval bases in Italy and Italy's possessions overseas that all have these Enigma machines. So there's probably 30 different places that are using these Enigma machines. And they are sending messages between themselves about what's going on. So there's very little traffic. There's probably two or three messages a day being intercepted. Which, compared with German Enigma, there's thousands. You know, it's very scantily used. Knox was in the cottages here at Bletchley. And in 1939, Peter Twin, Alan Turing, Joe Alexander, these people were all in there doing German Enigma. Once the first bomb machine has been delivered and German Enigma is being solved in Hut 6, Knox's team is left to carry on with the other versions of Enigma, which includes the Italian one and a similar one that's being used by the German intelligence services and various other things. So when the Italians pop up using this Enigma machine again, the first question is it the same machine as they were using before? Or even if it is the same machine, are the wirings of the rotors the same as they were before? The only way they can find that out is to try and break some messages. And this is where Mavis Beatty, or Mavis Lever as she was, comes into our story.
So she's working with Dilly Knox.
She's in Dilly Knox's team in Cottage 3, yes.
The wiping out of Bardia by combined land forces of the British and Australian Army, the Navy and the Royal Air Force adds another 25,000 prisoners to help make up the total of less than 400 admitted losses by the Italians. That sounds like crazy arithmetic, but it's Italian, not ours. Just to make quite sure, our people are sending their captives out of the danger zone. By thousands, the prisoners are being shipped to prison camps outside Egypt. Well, that's the end of Bardia. Events in Libya are now likely to proceed like a ladder in a stocking. What next? Tobruk? Benghazi? Tripoli? Time will tell.
Let's talk about Mavis then.
She is the key player in this story in many ways. In 1940, as I say, when Knox moves on to working on these other Enigma systems, and even previously when he was working on Zygalski sheets, he recruited a team which was entirely female. I'm not quite sure how this came about, but he would identify women that he thought were good people and he would have them on his team. He liked working with women more than he liked working with men.
Was that unusual then?
It was pretty unusual, okay. Yes. I mean, probably all of the teams at Bletchley Park have women in them, but in most cases, they are doing what would be considered at the time to be female roles. So sort of they're in more sort of junior tasks. But he creates a team that entirely consists of women. And there are some pretty high-powered people in there. Margaret Rock is famous. She wasn't famous for a long time because she continued to work at GCHQ until the 1970s, I think. So there are women in there who are very good at what they do. It's into this team that Mavis Lever, as she was, comes in May of 1940. To dial back a bit, Mavis Lever at the time was 19 years old.
So young.
Yeah. She'd grown up in East Dulwich. Her father was a sorter at the local post office. Her mother was a dressmaker. She'd been educated at St. Columba's Catholic Girls' School in Croydon, studied German while she was at school. The family also went to Germany on holiday in 1936. They took a trip down the Rhine. And you have to imagine at that point, 15-year-old Mavis speaking German on behalf of the family as they travelled around. She did more German in the sixth form and won a scholarship to go to study German at University College London. She was only 17 when she won the scholarship, so she's...
Oh, incredible.
She's doing pretty well at that point.
Does her language background then give her a good foot through the door into work at Bletchley Park?
Yes.
Is that why she's here?
We're assuming that she's here because she spoke German.
Okay.
It's ironic that she gets put on the team that deals with Italian. She does later go on to work on German traffic as well. But part of it was she was studying German Romantic poetry at UCL, and UCL announced that they were going to relocate to Aberystwyth to avoid bombing in London. And Mavis took a look at this and went, I'm not going to go and study Romantic poetry in Aberystwyth when there's a war on. There must be more useful things to do. So she spoke to her tutor at UCL, who was a chap called Leonard Willoughby, who, like many academics in these sorts of departments, had fingers in pies.
He knew people who knew people.
And she finds herself in the Foreign Office, in the office of Miss Moore, who we've come across before, who was the principal female recruiter for the Foreign Office and for GCNCS in particular. And she interviewed Mavis and clearly thought, yeah, this is someone who we need. And she was moved into the Ministry of Economic Warfare, dealing with telegraph codes. These are public codes that you can buy in a stationery shop that allow you to shorten your telegrams so they're cheaper. They're not secret as such. That's the main function. So she was working, doing things with those, and somebody clearly spotted that she had a bit of a talent because she joins the Ministry of Economic Warfare in January 1940. By May, she's been moved to Bletchley Park. So the system is working because she's been identified as somebody who can do this sort of work. This is where, how can I put this politely, I challenge Mavis's account slightly.
Right.
Or I challenge how her account has been interpreted, because Mavis Lever lived until 2013, so she was able to tell her story to a number of people, including our august podcast producer, Mark. And there are various things that she pulls out of her account, which get regularly quoted. Apparently, the first thing that Dilly Knox said to her when she arrived in Cottage 3 was, "We're breaking machines, have you got a pencil?"
Okay.
Which is kind of in at the deep end, you know, let's crack on.
Yeah.
She went on to say that she was given little or no training. Quote, "So you had to work it all out from scratch." My interpretation of that is that what she's meaning is she didn't go on any formal training. She wasn't sent on a course on how to do cryptography or anything like that. Some people were. There were courses in operation at that period, training people. But she certainly didn't go on one. She's basically straight into the action. But from her later descriptions of what she was working on, it's clear that she's using this rodding technique that Dilly Knox had invented.
Mm.
So she hasn't broken Enigma from scratch, you know. As the way some people have interpreted it, she's using a technique.
Yeah.
Someone at the next desk said, this is how you do it. That's no discredit to her, because rodding is extremely complicated and difficult, and it requires quite a lot of guesswork and lateral thinking and sort of originality, even once you've got the technique, because you need to kind of plug in words that you think might occur in the message and then manipulate them to see if they come out in the ciphertext. It's not a straightforward task. So to say she didn't invent that isn't doing her any disfavor, really.
But it's interesting what you say about how what she said may have been interpreted by others and then sort of taken on a life of its own in terms of the history of these things. You know, it could have been she was being modest about what she was doing, or
exactly.
sort of the simplicity of the structure of how things worked here, you know, in yeah. saying, oh, there was no training, wasn't necessarily saying nobody told me what to do. But
exactly.
Yeah.
Also, you get the point that when people say, well, what did you do? She'd say, well, I did this. Knox's team, there were about 9 women there, I think.
Okay.
There's a famous poem that lists them all. After Matapan, Dilly Knox wrote this poem. And he lists 10 women, one of whom is the tea lady. And they were all basically doing the same thing as Mavis was. But she doesn't say, I and 8 other women were doing this. She says, I was doing it. So, which is not unreasonable.
Yes.
She wasn't asked what the 8 other women were doing.
Exactly.
But it's how that becomes interpreted later. But one thing that I think we can definitely give her credit for is, as I said, when this Enigma machine was reintroduced by the Italian Navy, the question is it the same machine? Is it using the same rotors? Basically, will our previous techniques work? And so they're all set to taking messages and rodding them to try and get a solution. And the way you do that is you take a crib, a guess word, and you plug it in and you see if it fits. The word that Dilly Knox suggested was P-E-R-X, pair X. And what that means is pair is 2, as in an address, you know, 2 Bletchley Park from the Admiralty, you know.
Got you.
And he said, well, try pair. And they knew that X was used as a word separator because there's no space bar on an Enigma. And the ciphertext is broken arbitrarily into 5-letter groups. So what you do is you put an X between each word. So per X is 2 space and then whoever the addressee is. So they're all sitting there rodding per X and seeing what they can get. It's in September 1940 that Mavis Lever tries P-E-R-S, which, as she says, proved to be personale, meaning personal,
You know,
which you might put at the beginning of a message, yes. you know, personal for Captain Smith.
Yeah.
And from that crib, she breaks a complete message. And it's clear from that that the rotors are the same, the machine is the same, and that the technique will work. Dilly Knox was so pleased with that that he took her out for dinner in the Fountain Inn in Stony Stratford as a thank you.
So, it was a big moment.
It was quite a big moment, yeah. The boss took her out for dinner. You know, she could definitely claim the credit for that one. They're now back into Italian Enigma. It may only be 2 or 3 messages a day, but given that they can't read the book codes, it's a pretty big deal. Suddenly they're reading Italian traffic.
It must have been such a feeling of elation when you finally hit it. You've been trying and trying and for it to actually work. It must have been an incredible feeling.
Yeah, I mean, this is September. She joined in May. Mm. They've been working for quite a long time.
Were there any crucial breaks going forward from there?
There were. And what's striking is that Frank Birch, who was the head of Naval Section, and he wrote the history of Naval Section after the war, he picks out the fact that these few Enigma messages that they had were, what he calls them, is fitful gaps in fog.
In March 1941, Naval Special Intelligence concerning the Mediterranean was very sparse indeed. The Italians, soon after their entry into the war, had made a complete change of their high-grade books and enciphering tables, and since August 1940, a thick fog had descended on the scene. In this fog was one small, fitful gap. The Italians were still using a type of Enigma machine that they had employed during the Spanish Civil War. Traffic was slight in volume and could not all be decrypted, but it included intelligence of first-rate importance.
This is where we come to one of these pieces of intelligence of first-rate importance. After the break that they've made with the personale, Mavis Beatty talks about how there were a series of messages that they were able to break because they related to Italian miniature submarines. The Italians had a program of what were referred to as human torpedoes, which is if you imagine a torpedo with a little kind of steering wheel on the top and a frogman sitting on it, and you drive it into an enemy harbour and you point it at a ship and you swim away at the crucial moment and it hits the ship. And yeah.
Are you being serious?
Yeah, serious.
Oh my goodness. I had no idea such things existed.
Well, they do. And the Italians were the experts at it. And they attacked the Royal Navy in Alexandria successfully and they attacked Gibraltar. There's a whole separate story about Italian frogmen and human torpedoes, which we're not going to go into today.
I mean, I think this should be another podcast episode.
But what it meant was there was quite a lot of traffic with, I'm going to murder the Italian, the word sommergibili in it. And sommergibili is a submersible or something, in this case, a human torpedo. They were having quite a lot of success with traffic because that word is a nice, long, recognisable word. That if that's going to be in the message, you can use it. And so that they're making progress, but none of this is vitally important. until you get to the 25th of March. And on the 25th of March, Mavis Sleaver was able to break a rather cryptic but very important message. This message in due course was teleprinted to the Admiralty in London and then forwarded on to the CNC in the Mediterranean. And I can read you the message verbatim. This is the English version, deciphered and translated. Reference your 53148 of 24th. Today, 25th March, is day minus three. Acknowledge.
Oh, that is cryptic.
So what it's saying is the 28th of March is day.
What is happening on the 28th?
What is happening on the 28th of March? What's interesting about this is Mavis described very exactly how they were able to break this message. And what I should have said when I read it out, to use the sort of telegraph parlance, there are full stops in this message. It says, reference your 53148 of 24th, stop. Today, 25th March, is day minus three, stop. Acknowledge, stop. Because there's no punctuation on an Enigma machine, the Italians used the abbreviation ALT for full stop. And they would bracket it with X's, the word separators. So the team in Cottage 3, including Mavis, attacked these messages by looking for XALTX. And there's three XALTXs in this message, even though it's a line long. It's got three full stops in it. You need to be able to guess a word in the message.
Gotcha.
For the rodding to work. And if you guess the word for full stop, you've got a pretty good chance that the message is going to have a full stop in it somewhere. So what you can do is you can try XALTX in all the different positions in the message. And what is slightly mind-boggling about this is if you imagine the Enigma machine itself has three 26-position rotors, that's 17,576 positions. Also, it has a settable reflector, as it's called, so it has another 26 positions. What they'd done is they'd enciphered XALTX on all of those however many thousand positions and made a catalogue of all of the different possible encryptions.
Oh, my God.
So what you do is you get your message and you get five letters from your message, which you think might be XALTX, and then you go through this catalogue of thousands of possibilities.
Manually, of course.
Manually. And you try and see if you can get the right one. And what was particularly satisfying about this was when they found the first full stop, that gave them the position of the Enigma machine when that full stop was enciphered, when that XALTX was enciphered. But then if you find the next full stop, it corresponds to that many clicks forward in the Enigma machine. So it confirms that you're right because the correct encryption has come up that many positions forward in the machine. And then you go forward again, another however many letters there are in acknowledge, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 letters. You go forward again and you get XALTX again, correctly enciphered.
Yes.
So you've got sort of three confirmations in this one sentence that you're absolutely on the money with the encryption or the decryption in this case. It's very easy to say they made a catalogue of all the encryptions of XALTX, but given that they're doing this by hand, it's kind of crazy.
My brain wants to understand, is this like a card index? Is it a map on the wall? Is it a chart? Like, how are they
It's probably
doing
just a
this?
Ring binder full of pages and pages and pages of handwritten
wow.
stuff. These are things you can create using the Hollerith machines in Block C, or they were later in Block C, they were in Hut 7 at this point. But Italian naval section doesn't get a lot of access to Hollerith. So things that you might have been able to do on Hollerith, they often just do them by hand. So once again, Mavis Lever is very happy. She's going, this is amazing. You know, the Italians are finally going to do something. You know? But as you say, the question is what? The answer to what might happen on the day, partly at least, comes in on the following day, on the 26th, which is day minus two, when a substantially longer Enigma message is broken. We know what that message said because it was teleprinted from Bletchley Park to the Admiralty in London, and the teleprint copy is on file in the National Archives.
A telegram from Rome to Rhodes, sent at 22:45 on March the 24th, contains instructions for the following aerial operations to be carried out as preliminaries to the main operation. First, in the morning hours of the 2 days preceding the main operation, reconnaissance of Alexandria Suda and traffic en route Alexandria Piraeus via Carso and Corrigo. Second, on the night preceding the day, attack on Cretan aerodromes. Third, from dawn to midday of the day of the main operation, intensive reconnaissance of the area bounded by Crete, the Peloponnese, the Gulf of Aegina, and the line Zia, Milo, Cape Sidero. At dawn of the same day, reconnaissance of route Caso Alexandria, and the Gaudo Alexandria, and attack on Cretan aerodromes. Results of reconnaissance to be sent to Stamage and the Admiralty in the usual manner. Signed, Guzzoni.
That's an incredibly detailed message.
It is. It's not actually about the operation, but what it's saying is the German and Italian air forces need to be in lots of places around Crete and southern Greece to provide air cover for whatever the thing is that's going on. And given it's the sea south of Crete, there's only one thing that could be going on in the sea south of Crete, which is that the Italian Navy is going to be stooging about. So it's really important stuff. The real irony of this is that this message is not sent by the Italian Navy. It's actually sent by General Guzzoni, Alfredo Guzzoni, who is a member of the Italian High Command, the Comando Supremo, and it's orders for the Air Force. As you heard in the message, it's all about air cover from here to there to where. But it was sent using Naval Enigma to the Italian naval officer commanding in the island of Rhodes. Rhodes is near where these operations are going to happen, and some of the Italian aircraft are based on Rhodes. But the Italian naval commander in Rhodes doesn't actually have anything to do with Operation Gaudo. This is sent to him for information only. He's not expected to do anything on the basis of this message. He's just been kind of copied in.
He's
been copied in. And so this message has been sent to him. And the irony of the story really is that they didn't need to send this message at all.
Oh, gosh.
The guy they sent it to didn't really need to know.
We talk about this quite a lot on the podcast. Human error, not necessarily error in this case, because I assume there's protocol that's being followed in order for certain people to have information.
Absolutely. There was procedures. You had to follow procedures.
Yes.
You know, he'd be very upset if he wasn't copied in.
Yes. But this is, I'm going to say, their downfall, and that sounds very dramatic, but it's those kind of things that aren't actually essential, or people not sort of thinking defensively in a way that you might expect them to, that allows us to find more information.
Military organisations are nothing if not bureaucratic and hierarchical, and a lot of it is about making sure that you please the right people and you know, everyone, you know, who feels they should be copied in is told and everything else.
And for the work of people here at Bletchley Park, it's understanding that culture. So when you have a message, a piece of information, not just thinking that literally what is the sort of syntax or the grammar of this, but who's it's being sent to and why would they need to know that?
And also it doesn't describe what's actually going to happen. It doesn't mention the fact that Italian battleships are going to go to Crete. All of that is an inference from information about something else. It's putting these fragments together and going, right, on the day, which is in 3 days' time, something is going to happen that needs all this air support. What could it be that's going to happen? And there's really only one thing logically that's going to happen. This is also supported because there is a German Enigma message that's also broken at around the same time.
So corroboration.
Because the German Luftwaffe, German Air Force Enigma, their red key has been broken since early 1940. That was the first key that Bletchley Park broke. In addition, they introduced a key called Light Blue that was specifically for the Luftwaffe in North Africa. And that had been started to be broken in February of 1941. So I'm not sure which channel it came from, but the message comes from the German Air Force saying that they're flying aircraft from North Africa to Sicily, where they will remain for a few days to support. And so the Germans are supporting something as well. You throw that into the mix, you have a pretty good impression of what's going to happen.
Front North Africa. Panzer gehen vor. Stoßtrupps arbeiten sich vor und dringen in kühnem Angriff in die britischen Verteidigungslinien ein. Die harten und erbitterten Kämpfe in Afrika gehen weiter.
You mentioned earlier that the Italians were doing as the Allies were doing, breaking codes. Can you tell us a bit about that side of the story?
The intelligence picture that the Italians have doesn't only come from code breaking, it also comes from other forms of intelligence and air reconnaissance in particular. They're flying aircraft over Alexandria in Egypt, photographing the Royal Navy, keeping tabs as far as they can on British ships in the Mediterranean. While the British had been shut out of Italian Navy book codes in 1940, the reverse wasn't true. The Italians were able to read Royal Navy codes not all the time and not necessarily very quickly, but they could break some Royal Navy traffic. So they have people doing that, and they're certainly doing a lot of traffic analysis and listening for material, even if they can't necessarily break it. They're still intercepting it and analysing it.
Did we have any suspicions they were reading our traffic?
Not of the high-level codes. That's one of the big failures of the Royal Navy, to understand that their codes being broken. These are the same systems, or similar systems, are being broken during the Battle of the Atlantic. And the Germans and the Italians are sharing their code-breaking expertise with each other. And it's not really until 1943, at which point the Italians are about to fall out of the war, that the Allies really get on top of their naval codes being broken. So some high-grade traffic is being read. And the other thing the Italians are quite good at is tactical codes. So these are much simpler systems where, if, for example, you have a reconnaissance aircraft flying around in the air and it needs to communicate with its base, the pilot in the aircraft can't use a complicated high-level book cipher. He has a much simpler sort of system. There are a variety of different ways of doing that, but none of them are very secure. But the idea is they don't need to be very secure for very long because they're quite low-grade information. But they do become important in this situation, because there's another interesting Italian. Those who listen to our January podcast will know I'm keen on interesting Italians. This is a chap called Eliseo Porta. His family owned several factories in Turin. He was a very wealthy man. He was something of a socialite, so he could basically do what he liked. He was the naval attaché to the Crown Prince of Italy in the 1930s. He went to the coronation of George V with the Italian Crown Prince. You know, he mixed in posh circles. But he was also an Italian naval officer. By his own claim, he joined the Regia Marina, the Italian Navy, for the sport, not for the money. He just thought it'd be a good laugh to be in the Navy.
We're getting a picture of the man.
We're getting a picture. But what he got interested in was these tactical codes, these air-to-ship codes and minor ship-to-ship systems. His team that he built up in Rome got pretty good at both intercepting this stuff and breaking it. But in 1940, as I said, when the two navies were sort of sparring with each other, he broke a lot of this traffic, but he was breaking it in Rome, and breaking it in Rome didn't really help because getting it back to the ships at sea took so long that by the time it got there, it was redundant. So he campaigned to go on the ships, and Admiral Iacino, who led Operation Gaudo, who was the Italian commander at Matapan, he supported Porta, and in 1941, Porta is allowed to take a small team of codebreakers onto the Vittorio Veneto, which is the Italian flagship battleship that Iacino's on. So you have a small tactical code-breaking team actually on the battleship with the admiral, so that anything that's intercepted can be handed over straight away. And Porta was captured and interviewed extensively in 1944 after the Italian armistice, and he wrote a report describing this whole thing about what he was doing. And in that report, he gives the traffic he was able to intercept for the Battle of Matapan. And it's really interesting because he lists 95 messages that he intercepted over the 4 days of the battle. And you get the verbatim Italian version of the message. Obviously, he has intercepted a message in English that has been enciphered. He has then rendered it in his report in Italian. And I had to go on Google Translate and turn it back into English again.
Okay.
What's quite interesting is, while the Italians don't know very much about what the British are doing, they know an awful lot about what the British know about the Italians. The simple explanation is, if the British send an aircraft from their aircraft carrier to go and look for the Italian ships, and they find them, they send a message back, which Porter is able to hear on the Italian battleship. And he goes, oh, boss, we've just been found by an aircraft. So the British know where we are.
Yeah.
So they can follow how much the British know about the situation on that basis. Unfortunately, their strategic intelligence is much poorer. In the build-up to the battle, there are these reconnaissance aircraft flying over Alexandria and reporting on the Royal Navy. And these reports, by and large, are either out of date or plain wrong. And so poor old Iacino is being fed these messages that say, there's one battleship in Alexandria, there's three battleships in Alexandria, there's no battleships in Alexandria because they're all at sea. There's an aircraft carrier. Oh, no, the aircraft carrier's over near Crete. No, it isn't. You know, it's completely inconsistent flood of information that's basically useless because it's all, as I say, either out of date or wrong. So he really struggles to understand what's going on. And the operation has been launched basically on the assumption that the Royal Navy is a lot weaker than it actually is. The Germans turn up and tell him that they've torpedoed two of the battleships in Alexandria and you don't need to worry about them. But in fact, they haven't. They launched a raid and the pilots came back and went, oh yeah, my torpedo hit a battleship, definitely. Yeah, it's sunk now, boss.
Okay.
Which it hadn't been. So the only really reliable intelligence he's getting, or the first-hand intelligence he's getting, is from Porter on board, but it's not really giving him a full picture.
We have this intelligence then, something is going to happen. Some indications as to what it might be. How do things play out?
Well, first you have to look at who's involved. And the Italians, as I said, their ships are dispersed in all these ports around Italy. The idea is that two forces of cruisers, so medium-sized ships, each of three cruisers, will sail. And they will meet up with Italy's remaining battleship, the Vittorio Veneto, which has Admiral Iacino on it. So they'll have one battleship and these six cruisers. They've got another two light cruisers, and they've got about 17 destroyers, which are sort of small escort ships. And this will form up into a big fleet, and it will sail to the south of Crete and shoot up British convoys and generally cause havoc. So they set off. Admiral Cunningham, British Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean, has his three battleships, rather old battleships, Barham, Valiant and Warspite, in Alexandria. And he also has one aircraft carrier. He has HMS Formidable. But also there is a small force of British cruisers. There's three British cruisers up in Piraeus in Greece. So the British have Force A and B in the Admiralty account, and the Italians have what are essentially two cruiser forces in the battleships. So they have forces, which the British call them forces W, X and Y. But you've got the Italians coming from west to east past the bottom of Greece. And Cunningham, his plan is to sail out from Alexandria, meet up with the cruisers from Greece, catch the Italians in the sandwich, have a big naval battle, destroy the Italian fleet. But his big fear is that if the Italians cotton on the size of force he's got and that it's at sea, they'll just turn around and go home. They've done this before. So he is anxious that he should keep his plan as secret as possible. And so the first thing that happens on the 26th is that a British reconnaissance aircraft sees some of the Italian ships. A Sunderland flying boat sees them, and that report is sent to Cunningham. And so it's like, right, the Italian Navy's at sea. I need to go to sea to fight them. At the same time, Commander Porter on the Italian battleship has intercepted the same message from the aircraft, and he goes to Iacino and says, we've been spotted, boss. But Iacino is under such political pressure from his bosses back in Rome and the Germans and everybody else that, although the wise thing to do might have been to turn around, he's in a position where he's being squeezed to fight a battle. He can't really back out at this point. So even though he knows his cover's been blown, he carries on. Cunningham, meanwhile, needs to sail from Alexandria, but he doesn't want to give the game away for as long as possible. So he decides he won't sail until after dark on the 27th. And this is where one of the more famous stories of Matapan comes about, because he knows that Alexandria is a hotbed of spies and informants and everything else, and that basically anything the Royal Navy does, the enemy will hear about pretty quickly.
Okay.
And in particular, there is a Japanese naval attaché, because Japan isn't in the war yet at this point. Japan is still neutral. So there's a Japanese attaché in Alexandria who is well known to be reporting everything the Royal Navy does back to the Germans. So Cunningham comes up with a ruse to persuade the Japanese attaché that nothing is happening. And his flag officer, his sort of assistant, Captain Hugh Lee, described in a letter to Mavis Beatty how this happened.
He then said, I am going for a game of golf. And I went with him. After the game, making sure that the local spy, the Japanese consul, was in earshot, the Admiral discussed with me the details of a mythical dinner party ashore that evening, put the empty suitcases in the car, and went to have a cup of tea with Lady Cunningham at the residency, which he had been lent to live in. At 6:30 p.m, as darkness fell, the Admiral and I returned to HMS Warspite, and the fleet sailed at 7 p.m.
It is kind of hilarious that he's there going, oh, I'm going out to dinner tonight. Are you coming to dinner? Let's play golf.
Slightly raised voice, just so yeah. It's in the wind and catches ear.
It sort of conjures up this image of him being stalked around the golf course by, and apparently the Japanese attaché was a particularly overweight individual. And the idea of him kind of crouched in a bush, which I'm sure he wasn't.
No.
But, you know, the story conjures up those kinds of images. Basically, as soon as it gets dark, Cunningham legs it back to the Warspite and the fleet sails under cover of darkness. The hope is that it's not until the following morning that anyone will notice that the fleet have gone and they'll have a 12-hour at least head start on the Italians. But Captain Lee records that Cunningham was probably still quite sceptical, because apparently he bet Captain Lee 10 shillings that they would never see the Italians. He wasn't necessarily confident of catching them, but he thought it was worth a try. During the battle itself, Porter and his team continue to intercept aircraft reports from the British. Unfortunately for the Italians, most of those messages are describing where the Italian ships are, and they're not able to infer from them where the British ships are. And throughout, Admiral Iachino thinks that Cunningham's force is a lot further away than it actually is. And you have to kind of hold that thought, because that's what leads to the disaster for the Italians. Is his conclusion from all this mixed messaging he's had is that the British battleships and the aircraft carrier are 100 plus miles away when they're not. The British cruisers that have come down from Greece haven't yet met up with Cunningham and the battleships, so they're sort of on their own. They meet some of the Italian cruisers, but the problem is the Italian ships have 8-inch guns and the British ships have 6-inch guns, which you wouldn't think is a big discrepancy. But the problem is the Italian ships have a longer range, so they can basically steer to make sure that they're always in range of their guns, but out of range of the British guns. So the British cruiser force, Admiral Pridham Whipple, he can't fight them. He basically has to turn away every time they appear. There's a brief battle where the Italian cruisers attack Force B, the British cruiser force. And then later on, the Italian battleship Vittoria Veneto appears and again has a go at the cruisers.
Okay.
And they have to turn away again. And at that point, Iachino decides, we should probably give up. It looks like the convoy we were hoping to destroy clearly isn't here. The Royal Navy is coming. You know, the game's up. We should probably go back to Italy. So he draws all of his various forces together into one group and basically starts to head back to Italy. The problem Admiral Cunningham has is his battleships, although they're very powerful, are very slow. And so if they simply chase after the Italians, they're never going to catch them. The only chance he has is to send aircraft from his aircraft carrier or land-based aircraft in Crete to drop torpedoes and try and, if not sink the Italian fleet, slow it down so that he can catch it up. There are several air attacks, both from HMS Formidable and from aircraft from Crete, on the various bits of the Italian fleet. They do manage to get one torpedo hit on the Vittoria Veneto, the battleship, and it does slow it down. But it doesn't really slow it down enough. It slows it from about 30 knots maximum speed to about 22 knots maximum speed. The British ships can only do 20 knots, so it's still faster than the British ships. So it's not done enough. But then a subsequent air attack, one aircraft manages to torpedo one of the Italian heavy cruisers, a ship called the Pola. And the Pola, basically, its engines blow up and it stops. So the Italian fleet sails on and this ship is left stranded. Night falls on the 28th and the Italians are worried about this ship. So Iachino tells his subordinate, who's in command of the group of three cruisers, of which the Pola was one, he says, you can take the other two cruisers back to go and rescue the ship that stopped. Because at this point, he thinks Cunningham's far enough away that this won't be a problem. The other two cruisers from the force, the Zara and the Fiume, steam back to where the Pola is stationary with a couple of destroyers for escort in the evening of the 28th. What they fail to appreciate is Cunningham and his battleships are basically right there. And the first thing the Italians know about it, they're steaming back southwest. Their gun turrets are all pointing, you know, fore and aft. They're just not expecting anything. Because the British ships have got radar, which the Italian ships haven't, they don't realise they've been being stalked on radar by the British. And the first thing they know about is when these powerful naval searchlights switch on and there are three British battleships in a line more or less about 2 miles away, which in naval terms is extremely close range. And the British battleships fire their guns for less than 5 minutes. But in that 5 minutes, they are able to completely destroy the two Italian cruisers that have come back. One of them sinks immediately. The other one is on fire from stem to stern and sinks later in the evening. They also sink two of the accompanying destroyers. And then later at night, the stationary one, the Pola, is sunk by some British destroyers. So in about 5 minutes, three major ships of the Italian Navy plus two destroyers have been sunk. And Cunningham turns away and goes back to Alexandria. And so the Italians have suffered a massive material loss. Something like nearly 2,500 Italian sailors have been killed. Three major ships have been sunk. The total loss to the British is one aircraft shot down and the three crew in that aircraft. The Royal Navy ships are undamaged. So it's decisive. Again, the legend will tell you that the Italian Navy went back to port and never came out again. That's an exaggeration. There were further operations by the Italian Navy, but it's a major blow to their morale and their material strength. They've lost three very significant ships and they are put on the back foot for the rest of the war. So it's an important event. Churchill, because he liked to, you know, make the most of these things, calls it the Royal Navy's greatest victory since Trafalgar. But in March 1941, things weren't looking very great for the British. I think he needed something to make the most of. It's a big deal. And although during the battle itself, signals intelligence has a relatively small part to play. The reason the Royal Navy is there at all traces back to Dilly Knox and Mavis Beatty and the girls in Cottage 3 and their work on Italian Enigma. Admiral Cunningham actually came to Bletchley Park to meet the team and say thank you. And I think the best way to round this off is to hear Mavis talk about that moment.
Normally, you see, one didn't ever know, and this is what we can't get people to understand, that if you're a codebreaker, you didn't necessarily know what the messages were saying, that once you broke one message for a day, that the setting which the operator was using would cover the rest of the day, and you just took it through to a machinist who ran it all off, so that you might break a message which said nothing to report, and you wouldn't know something later on, which was just what General so-and-so wanted or somebody else wanted, because we just didn't know, because that was not the way need-to-know worked. However, Matapan was different. The first message, a tiny message, said, today's the day -3, X -3. Oh, goodness, the Italians are going to do something. What is it they're going to do? And this was, of course, 3 days before Matapan, so that was the 25th of March, 41, and that was when we got the message. So then we heard what was going to happen on D-Day -2 the next day, when we were up all night, of course, and then waiting for the next day, D-Day 1, and then D-Day. So everything had to get out to Cunningham in time. Well, of course, it was a marvellous battle, because it was at a very bleak time, March 1941. And, of course, traditionally, a naval victory is very good for the British public. And Churchill was over the moon, and he said that there was nothing like it, no fight since Trafalgar, and Cunningham was as good as Nelson, and so on. And then came the message through from the Admiralty at midnight, tell Dilly we have won a great victory in the Mediterranean, and it's all thanks to him and his girls.
But then Cunningham, of course, comes up and thanks you, doesn't he?
Oh, Cunningham, yes, Cunningham came himself a few months afterwards when he was on leave. And we, Admiral Godfrey brought him over, and we rushed down to the 8 bells at the end of the road to get some drink, some wine. I'm sure it wasn't up to what the standard CNC Mediterranean was used to, but he also drank to us. So that, of course, imagine what that was like to a bunch of 19-year-olds. We were terribly pleased about that. We were in this little cottage, and the walls had just been whitewashed. Now, this will show you how sort of silly and young and giggly we were, but we thought it would be jolly nice if we could talk to Admiral Cunningham and to get him to lean against the wet whitewash and go away with a white stern. So that's what we did.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.